Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
All the hearts who are content and all who feel unworthy and all who hurt with nothing left will know that you are holy. And all will sing out hallelujah. We will cry out hallelujah. All will sing out hallelujah. We will cry out hallelujah.
Our scripture reading this morning is from 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 13 to 15. I do not mean that there should be relief for others and pressure on you, but it is a question of fair balance between your present abundance and their need, so that their abundance may be for your need, in order that there may be a fair balance. As it is written, the one who had much did not have too much, and the one who had little did not have too little.
It's probably clear to most everybody. I came down with a cold on Monday. Linda and I talked back and forth about how ridiculous it was for me to try to share, and I'm kind of obstinate, so thank you. Both of us are working on our growing edges. Yours is politeness and mine's obstinance. So, did that come out loud? Did I say that out loud? I did, didn't I? Will you please woman-splain this for me? So, one of the gifts, there's a lot of gifts of being a pastor, and one of the gifts of being a pastor is that I get to set, we get to set our own schedule. And so as best I could, and this is really hard for me too, I tried to slow down this week, and I tried to carve out some time to drink some tea. Somebody, yeah, that was the union organizer among us. Was that you, Greg? And so one of the gifts, I was able to go early to pick up my daughter at school, like when it gets out, not when the Club M ends. And we went home and we made juice and we made soup and we snuggled. And she got sick too and she was feeling terrible. And what I recognize in that is that my privilege to take that time away is not enjoyed by so many folks. And I walked headlong into that yesterday afternoon. I went with Carrie Parsons to another church, and we were doing some filming as they were welcoming a line outside, maybe 150 or so adults who were waiting outside of a church not far from here. They're waiting to go inside and to have a warm meal served to them, and then to take a bag of some groceries and toiletries. And I was talking with folks in line, and these are mostly people who are what we call working poor. They're working odd jobs, several jobs. They're barely scraping by. They have health issues. It was pretty clear there was some addiction struggles that were right there in the line. One of the people who was serving those, the ones who are in need, is a person who never could have taken the time that I did this week. She works the second shift, I learned, at a factory here in town. And if she took the time that I did to try to just slow down this week, she wouldn't have that second shift anymore. And so I was really aware of just the privilege that we talked about last week in our worship series. And it was hard to witness everything that I did as I was there. It was hard to stay at the table, as it has been for some folks, as we've talked about challenging topics. Our inclination is to try to run away from some of these things. With the best of intentions, these really great church folks were providing a meal and a handout. And it felt just like that. It felt like a handout. And so it was hard to witness because there was this line, right, that happens so often in the way we try to reach in love, where the people on one side are the servants, and the people on the other side are the served. The people on one side are the ones who pray, and the other side are the ones who are prayed for. And it really quickly becomes kind of overwhelming of, are we reaching in love? Are we doing good? Where are these lines and how do we blur them a little bit? And I don't pretend to have any easy alternative to that, what I witnessed. And I deeply value the desire of those church folks to do what we just sang about, to make a difference, to follow Jesus in offering radical hospitality to folks that are on the margins. And on a very real level, what I mostly need to just acknowledge is the sense of convictedness that I feel in the gulf between the privilege that I have and the reality of folks who are in line to try to get bags of groceries to just keep on keeping on with their family. And that gulf doesn't feel good. Gustavo Gutierrez says that you do theology differently when your stomach is full than when it's empty. Amen. So we've been trying to put challenging topics on the table these last 3 weeks. This week we're going to talk about 77 cents, and most of you guys have been asking us for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks, was 77 cents, was that a typo? Like, you've got all these clear things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about gun violence, we're going to talk about privilege, but 77 cents, did you guys, was that a mistake? And 77 cents is what women in our country make relative to each dollar that's made by men. And so we're going to try this morning to put income inequality generally on the table, but also more specifically the gender gap that's related to income inequality. And we're going to try to talk about that. Pastor Linda and I are, well, at least for me, my head can get really big sometimes. One of the things that happened, not just from the cold, but one of the things that happened as we've gone through these things, we're like, we should extend this series. We should do this for like the next 4 or 5 months, because every time we put an issue on the table, it like gets national and then international media coverage. This is amazing that this is happening, right? So we were going to talk about guns and gun violence. And on the Monday before we talk about it, there's this major address from the president about guns and gun violence. First time that it's talked about in that way from people in political leadership. And then as well, we started to talk this week, we're trying to talk this week about income inequality. And just on Friday, the White House announced a new proposal on cue. Like, they did this on cue. They waited till week 4 of this series. And they said, actually they timed it to coincide with Lilly Ledbetter's Fair Pay Act. This effort to require companies to report to the federal government what they pay employees by race and gender and ethnicity. It's an effort to try to crack down on firms that pay women less for doing the same work as men. And so this was put on the table as President Obama declared, women are not getting the fair shot that we believe every single American deserves. What kind of example does paying women less set for our sons and our daughters? And the article pointed out that women are making right now 79 cents on the dollar. That's progress, but clearly not adequate. And so critics were very quick to say that this is going to lead to frivolous lawsuits. That's where this is going to go. This is not a good idea. And we already have gender discrimination laws on the books. It's not legal to discriminate against gender. So my question then became, if gender discrimination is already illegal, then how do we have such a gulf between men and women in terms of income? Like, if it's already illegal, what is really at play here? And Hollywood, as Hollywood does, is often kind of putting some of these things on the table for us. We saw a really stark example right here. This is the cast from American Hustle. And so we learned when some Sony Pictures emails were released, they weren't released, I think they were like hacked is what actually happened, but they were hacked, and we learned that Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams made phenomenally less money than their male counterparts on this movie. And so it put literally on the table in a way that a lot of our country or maybe our world can see that this isn't fair, that these women were in this and they were paid substantially less. But then, interestingly, when Jennifer Lawrence reflected on how this happened, she wrote about it like, or she talked about it like this. She said, "I failed as a negotiator because I gave up early. I didn't want to keep fighting over millions of dollars that, frankly, due to two franchises, I don't need. But if I'm honest with myself, I'd be lying if I didn't say there was an element of wanting to be liked that influenced my decision to close the deal without any real fight. I didn't want to seem difficult or spoiled." So the story that's behind that example that was put on the table for us is how these cultural dynamics that both create and then reinforce income inequality are really complicated. It's not often that it's just like a blatant case of gender discrimination, but it's all kinds of things that are at play underneath this. And so this morning, I want to try to unpack some of that a little bit with you all and to try to get a sense of if it's not blatant discrimination, it's still unfair. And so how is God calling us to mend that, and what might that look like? And thankfully, several of you sent me links that I wasn't aware of to this podcast. How many people knew about this already? It's called Freakonomics, the true story of the gender pay gap. Okay, well, I was behind the curb, but it was really, really fabulous to listen to, and it helped shape some of my thinking. So I want to share one of the stories that came up in that. This is called, it's from a study in the late 1990s called Orchestrating Impartiality. And I was thinking about Brendan a lot as I was hearing this. So there's an economist, her name is Claudia Golden, and she did this study, and this is what she found. We found out that the best orchestras in the United States, most of them use a blind when they do auditions. So you can't see, right? They didn't in the past, and each one of them adopted this technique to having auditions. And the blind means that the individuals who are making the decision on the sound of the individual's performance, they don't get to see the individual that's actually playing. So there's a screen between them. And so she decided that since the various orchestras adopted the screen, that they could figure out whether the huge increase in women who are now in the great orchestras in the United States is due to the use of that screen. Is that like what caused this to happen? And so the interviewer, Steve Dubner, says, "So I guess one theory might be, if orchestras got a lot more females over time, it may just have been that the pool of female applicants grew, or the pool of male applicants shrunk. Like, that could have been reasonably at play. That's one of the possibilities. But they wanted to isolate the effect of the blind auditions. And they had names for these individuals. So they could actually trace when an individual had auditioned without a blind, what happened. And then when they auditioned with a blind and what happened. So they could see how our partiality, our being able to see someone's gender, played into this. And what they found was there was a 25% increase in women that moved into the orchestra when they put a blind up. But it wasn't just that, like, our partiality or, like, my male sexism. It was actually also the ability when women heard that there was going to be a blind, they were more likely to audition. So there were all kinds of things that were at play as this was happening, because the number of applicants went up in those orchestras when women knew that there was going to be a blind there and sexism would be off the table in a certain way, right? Phenomenal study as they were trying to figure out how do we make sense of some of this gap between income in women and men in our country. So this feels significant to me. felt really significant to me to learn this and to hear this. See, we can't just isolate the income gap. There is also an opportunity gap, right? That's there, that was determining, predetermining whether someone was even going to show up for an interview. Is it worth her time and money to travel someplace if she knows the deck is already stacked against her? And so we're going to have to put that on the table as we try to figure out, like, how do we find a greater balance in a society that is stacked against us? And it's going to take intentionality and nuance and really brilliant people like this woman, Claudia Golden, and others to come alongside to figure out, how do we look at this honestly and see the nuances and then find some creative ways forward to disrupt the social norms that have us trapped? And the Apostle Paul was trying to figure out in his day how to get over a very similar gap. See, there was a gap in his day, not just in ours, but back then as well. And in his day, it was an economic gap. And so he writes in depending on where you are, you can either say 2 Corinthians or you can say 2 Corinthians. He writes in 2 Corinthians. He writes in 2 Corinthians. I didn't just say that. This cold is coming over me, people. And he says to the wealthy people in Corinth, right? He says to the wealthy folks in Corinth, this is how he says it. I do not mean that there should be relief for others and pressure on you, but it is a question of fair balance between your present abundance and their need, so that their abundance may be for your need, in order that there may be a fair balance. As it is written, the one who had much did not have too much, and the one who had little did not have too little. This is Paul's way of inviting folks into radical generosity to try to bluntly take on a gap that was there in their day between the wealthy and the poor. He wasn't going to look the other way or allow folks to take that off the table. He said, let's deal with this. And this is my suggestion for how we do it. Folks who have a lot, let go of some of it. And folks that have a little, stay at the table so that is there for you. Paul isn't just making this up on his own. He's rooting his life in grace in Jesus. You can look back in Acts and you see where Paul is. He's getting this from. In Acts 2, it says, awe came upon everyone. So everyone means like the first folks that were trying to figure out how to follow Jesus. Like the first folks trying to figure out how to do this, they could have talked about anything. They could have gone in any direction. They were the first ones. And here's what they actually talked about. Here's what they spent their time on. Awe came upon them because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believe were together and had all things in common. They'd sell their possessions and goods and distribute proceeds to all as anyone had need. That is radical generosity. That's economic justice. That's the Bible. And it seems to be at the heart of our good news of the Christian gospel. Jim Wallace, he says it this way. I'd say that if our gospel isn't good news to the poor, it isn't an evangelical gospel. That's what I believe. I think that's right at the heart of the true evangelical tradition. And of course, 18th century Britain, John Wesley, and Methodism. Those are the people that came before us to try to show us the way. And so it isn't a coincidence that as the social gospel was rising in 1908 and folks were trying to figure out the gap in their day between the wealthy and the poor, United Methodists, we weren't even called that then, but Methodists came together in 1908 and they adopted a creed to try to figure out how do we stay at the table and put 77 cents, and in their day it was probably like 17 cents on the table. How do we deal with this? And this is what they said. We believe in God, creator of the world, and in Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of creation. We believe in the right and the duty of persons to work for the glory of God and for the good of themselves and others, and in the protection of their welfare in so doing, in the rights to property as a trust from God. That's an amazing clause right there. It's not just like in the rights to property. In the rights to property as a trust from God, collective bargaining and responsible consumption, and in the elimination of economic and social distress. They tied it together for us. Economic and social distress. That's what I walked into when I went to that church and folks were waiting in line. These two are enmeshed, as we talked about last week. And then we have this litany. And so I want a litany. We don't use these very often here at the table, but a litany is like a back and forth. It's a leader will say something and then the people will say something. So let's try it. Today is the day God cries with the masses of starving people despises growing disparity between rich and poor, demands justice for workers in the marketplace, and so shall we. That's who we are. That's what our tradition is calling us to be. But the church, as the church often does, screws this up a lot. And so the church should be on an edge. It should be like the church is leading the way toward justice, right? But instead, we have corporations and public entities that put 77 cents on the table. The church really would need to put 76 cents on the table. Because in churches around the country, there's this fabulous pastor and blogger. He's a United Methodist named Jeremy Smith. He wrote about this a couple weeks ago. He says that we witness a wage gap in the church as well between male and female clergy. This is one of the first things that Linda and I had to talk about, our age difference and our gender difference. And how do we deal with that in terms of what we're going to actually get paid here at the table, and how are we going to do that? And we keep working on it with our finance team to try to figure out, what does justice look like in this? What does it look like? And so we've chosen equality in that, in terms of how we structure that for ourselves. Our church has chosen that. National data reveals that women clergy earn 76 cents for every dollar that male clergy earn. In 2014, male clergy earned $1,007 more per week than women did. So $763. It's a that's per month is what it should say. It's a $12,000 difference is what Jeremy's trying to write about there. The gap among clergy is noteworthy because as an occupation, the credentialing process for the two of us, it's identical. It's exactly the same. It's like the teachers among us, all of these things where we have the same ways to get into that profession, you should be able to assume a level of equality that's there that in the church we don't get to assume. He writes that one contributing factor is the low percentage of pulpits. We don't really have one, but that's what this is, that have women who are preaching in this way. 11% of churches in the U.S. have solo female pastors or females as lead pastors in their churches. 11%. And you would think like, oh, we're such a nation that's moving toward progress. But over the last 18 years, it hasn't increased at all. That is embarrassing. That is embarrassing to be part of a church that isn't leading toward justice, but is behind the curve on folks like corporations and the public entities that are leading us. That's not what Paul had in mind. That's not what he meant. And so in all of this, my natural impulse is to try to figure out, like, who do we blame? Who do we blame? There is a problem. Who is responsible for this? And honestly, I was pretty ready to stand up and like, name that guy or myself in that role as we started this week. And then I kept listening to folks like Anne-Marie Slaughter and Claudia Golden, and kept coming back to how complicated the income gap actually is. That it isn't often like just a blatant discrimination between a man and a woman that are doing equal work in this way. That's not often, though it probably still happens. It inevitably still happens. Like, that's not going to solve our issue if we find those few isolated cases where that's happening. That's not going to make God's new creation. So Anne-Marie Slaughter thinks that it's really about men learning to be re-socialized. And so what she names is that we need to find ways to help men better understand our roles, in particularly with family. And so I want to confess, for the rest of this time, I'm going to talk a lot about families and about parenting. And I know we have a lot of folks in here that are neither parents nor in families nor ever want to be, and that's okay. But gender and income inequality comes down to this in a lot of ways. So I want to ask your permission to just like stay on it, because it's real, people, in terms of how this all gets played out. And Anne-Marie Slaughter wants men to figure out how do we take part in being primary caregivers in families. Why is it that when my family has a child, we assume that my wife is going to take 4 months off and I'm going to take a couple of weeks off? Like, what's going on in the ways, the assumptions that we make as we do that? Claudia Golden resonates with this, and then she studies it and finds all these like phenomenal nuances to how this plays out and what this looks like. And there's a number of studies that show the impact of re-socializing men. And the way that they try to do this is around giving men paternity leave. And so it's the kind of thing where we're not going to force, I'm going to use Michael and Jackie because y'all aren't going to have another kid. Michael, we could give Michael paternity leave, but we can't force him to use it. But we can incentivize him to use it. Like, you have these 4 months, or let's get all crazy, you have this whole year to be a parent, to just figure out how to love on your baby. Like, go do that. That's your primary responsibility. And if you don't use it, well, then you lose it. And there might be some men that are like, you know what, I'm not going to do that. But we could, as a culture, incentivize that. Incentivize how we structure our families and our work in that way. Claudia Golden doesn't really think that it's going to be possible. She thinks about it as 4 buckets of ways that we could try to solve this issue. And so these 4 buckets are, one, she uses the word fix. Like the Christian word for that, I'm going to say mend, right? But she uses the word fix. So we could fix women. You heard that in Jennifer Lawrence's thing, right? Make women more competitive, better bargainers, better at math, right? If we do that, she says, that could address the issue. We could fix infants. Like, actually, as a culture, take care of infants. We could prioritize that. That's another choice that we could make. Or we could fix men, she says, which is the point of that notion I just shared in terms of Michael offering him that incentive so that he becomes the primary caregiver in a way. And that doesn't sound radical. That just sounds normal. Or she says we could fix organizations, jobs. And she is focused on the last one, on fixing organizations. That's what Claudia Golden believes is the way forward. And so these are some of the things that she posits, and I want to lift them up for us because I think they're significant. She talks first about public schools. And what she says is our kids get out of school at 2:00, and then it ends in May. And so that system incentivizes one parent, and guess which one it is going to be in a straight couple, to stay home or to have a more flexible schedule so that they can be there for their child. I mean, this happened. We were in a meeting on Friday, and it happened with a young mom that we were meeting with as her child was sick, and she had to go back. Like, women disproportionately feel the burden of that because of the screwed up ways that we socialize folks around who's responsible for parenting. But it gets even more complicated. Like, every other week, my daughter's school has an early release day. So, like, come show up at 11:50 to pick your child up. Who gets off work at 11:50 to go pick their child up? Or in Linda's situation down in LA, they have late start day. So even if you have, like, one family in Sacramento, you got a different schedule just down the street in Elk Grove. And so all of this, she says, what it does is it encourages, and women step into this role because of the ways they're socialized, women to choose jobs that are more flexible so they can care for children and their own parents. And so she wants to rework some of those systems and those ways that we do that. Because the income gap, she said, isn't so much about obvious discrimination between men and women that are equally qualified. Instead, the gap is because women end up putting their jobs and their careers behind the sense of responsibility that they have to watch over their children and their parents in love. It's in large part why we're focusing so much on parents this morning. And the church is supposed to be about helping folks figure out how to watch over each other in love. So it feels like this is where we should have something to say. If that's the primary cultural thing that's happening that's underneath this gender income inequality, what kind of role could the church have to rethink this? The church has never been about trying to help us amass personal wealth or achieve monetary ambitions, no matter what prosperity gospel folks have to say about it. The gospel is always going to come back to generosity, radical generosity, and economic justice. So it seems that the church needs to figure out how to have a vital role in helping us. I hear, like, it resounds. The family values of the religious right have been yelled so loud that we might think this conversation has just already been lost. But friends, I don't believe that it has. We are here because of a long line of people who've been trying to show us a way to live into God's new creation. And one of those among us is Letty Russell. And that's her beautiful prophetic, powerful self right there. And her words, she's a pioneer in this movement. And one of the things that she says, and she uses theological language like talking to academics, so I want to try to just stay with me, right? In spite of the patriarchal nature of the biblical text, right, just like we talked about last week, it's embedded in sexism. In spite of that, I myself have no intention of giving up the biblical basis of my theology. With Rosemary Radford Ruther, so she's naming another person. She's not in this alone, but with other strong women, I argue that the Bible has a critical and liberating tradition that is embodied in a prophetic message of continuing self-critique. That's why the Bible keeps going. It's like story after story after story after story. It's all of us trying to figure out where God is calling us to next. It could have been so easy. This is the good news. Like one handout, check, done. But it's not. It is an unfolding story, and it always has been. And Letty invites us to see ourselves in that. She says, the evidence for a biblical message of liberation for women, as for other marginalized groups, is not found just in particular stories about women or particular female images of God, like the one we lifted up in that first song about all the poor and powerless. The evidence is found in God's intention for the mending of all of creation. That's where it's found. The Bible has authority in my life, she says, because it makes sense of my experience and speaks to me about the meaning and purpose of my humanity in Jesus Christ. And in spite of ancient patriarchal worldviews, in spite of inconsistencies that the Bible has and mixed messages that it gives, the story of God's love affair with the world, that leads me and you and all of us into a vision of a new creation that impels our lives. God's love affair with the world calls us to mend creation, to mend it. And part of this mending is to close the income gap, to find ways to move toward fair balance. Paul was calling followers of Jesus to move toward fair balance in their day, to mend the imbalance. Those earliest followers of Jesus in Acts, they were trying to do the same. Those well-intentioned church folks that were there yesterday on one side of a table, they were trying to do the exact same thing. They were trying to figure out how to express radical generosity, exactly what Jesus calls us to. And so this morning, I want to close us. It's going to take me a little bit, so don't jump up there, musicians. I want to close by celebrating some of the ways that I believe our little eclectic community of faith is challenging the gender income gap and joining with God in the mending of the world. And some of these are not going to feel obvious, but I believe they reflect a new creation that God's calling us to. A young gay couple from the South recently stood right here in this very space to declare their love for each other and their intention to enter into the sacred covenant of marriage. And as I counseled them in moving toward this day, one of the things we talked about was their hope for becoming parents, daddies. And inherently, as that happens in their lives, they are going to disrupt the gender norms, the social norms that we've come to assume. Just by their very being, it's going to happen. See, they're going to have to ask each other in ways that straight couples sometimes assume and don't even ask, who is going to take some time away from work? And what's it going to mean for that person's career? Because it doesn't just happen now. It means you're not going to get that promotion over the next year, so then you're not going to be in the same place 10 years from now or have the same pension 35 years from now. So it unfolds. And they're not going to be alone. They're going to know here in this space that there are other couples that have already tread that very path. And then they're going to invite straight folks to ask some of the same questions. Why is it that I make these assumptions about how we live and move and have our being? And what does it mean? We are folks in the midst of a baby boom in this church. We've got little Hayden over here rocking out with Peter. And I think she's the first of like three or four babies that have been born just in the last couple months. And there's like 8 or 10 more that are coming in the next couple of months. And so what an opportunity we have. What an opportunity we have to be with young parents as they try to navigate this together, as they try to make sense of what does it look like to interrupt this income inequality in our very lives. And some of us inevitably are going to choose more traditional gender roles. That's going to happen. Some of us are going to make that choice consciously. And then here's what I believe church allows. It allows us to always see that our way of doing it is not the only way. That right around us, my child is going to come up in a community that says, that is not the only way to do this. Here's how that happens, because it isn't just in families. See, when I was six and you went to Sunday school, you could assume that it was either a mommy or a grandma who was going to be there in a little chair to help you figure out how to color and write God is love. That's what we did. That's what it was. But it was a mom and a grandma that was there with you. And in just an hour or so from now, in this space, our children are going to go out of this room, and John Gooden, if you don't know John, I can't even get as tall as John is. John is 6'7", and he's easily 300 pounds. He would be a great left tackle for the Kansas City Chiefs. And and he's got tattoos everywhere. And John is going to, like, unfold his big body down onto the ground, and he is going to sit crisscross applesauce with a group of 7 and 8 and 9 year old kids, and he is going to tell a story about Julian of Norwich. Like, that is transgressing some things that we thought were normal, folks. That's what it looks like to live into the new creation that God's calling us to, because my daughter is not going to grow up with the same assumption that I did, that it is the grandma or the mom who's responsible for caring for the children as we go out of that space. And it's not just that. February 11th, over there in the social hall, Becca and Bambi, their same gender-loving relationship is already an embodiment of the new creation that God's calling us to. And so they're going to take this curriculum that's from Dave Ramsey. Dave Ramsey is no, like, let's reconstruct social norms kind of guy. But they're going to take this, and they're going to say, how do we use what is good from this to help folks figure out how to put their financial lives back together? And so they're going to do that in the room over there. And among us, folks, there was a person in this room who heard that this was going to happen and realized this person, she wanted to share. She knew she needed this when she was a young single mom. And so she said, I want to sponsor somebody else that needs this because they might not have the means to do it. I think that's what Paul meant. Like, I recognize my abundance in whatever way, and I want to make sure that I'm reaching in love to help somebody else. And so that's our question this morning. That's my question, and maybe it's your question. How is God calling all of us to mend that income gap? What's it going to look like to disrupt that 77-cent cycle that we find ourselves in? And perhaps it's just being more informed and understanding how all of our choices are always already embedded in systems that are hurting folks. And perhaps it's a call to figure out how do we use the privilege that we have to take some of this on headlong, as Paul was. That was a privileged place to write a letter to folks and say, I think you need to let go of some of the money that you're holding on to because other people need it. And perhaps we'll hear those words and we'll see our own abundance. Maybe it hasn't been clear to us how abundant we are. I'm positive the abundance that we have, most all of us in this space, it dwarfs the folks that Paul was writing to, folks. Like, it just dwarfs. So what if we could see that? May we see that? May we see God calling us to mend the gap in income this day and every day. Amen.
When a bullet flies and a child dies, can we overcome? Can we overcome? When all we see is inequality, can we overcome? Can we overcome? Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome.